Hello and welcome to our micronutrients presentation on the lovely vitamin E. So we're going to take vitamin E and we're going to become friends with vitamin E and discover how vitamin E works. We're going to take a look at some studies using vitamin E in clinical settings and see what kind of things vitamin E is good for, what kind of things vitamin E is proposed to be good for, but not necessarily showing up in clinical trials and the like. As usual, this information isn't intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare practitioner. And when you're working with your clients and you're explaining how vitamin E works and how you think they might have a deficiency, you're making sure to tell them that you're not diagnosing and you're not treating, you're just educating them on how the body's working and how some signs are showing that their body may not be working. And then they need to check in with their doctor if they're on any medication, that this is not intended to treat any condition or disease, even though some of the materials do indicate that there's some definite benefits there. So we're going to go through and talk about the basics about vitamin E. And then we're going to talk about what kind of things it does in the body. We're going to talk about where it comes from in the food chain and some of the things that we can do with it and how we can assess whether our client is low in vitamin E. So vitamin E is fat soluble. We mostly know that. And remember, there's the fat soluble and the water soluble vitamins. It's an antioxidant. And the vitamin E term describes a family. It's not just vitamin E. Like vitamin C is ascorbic acid, but vitamin E is a bunch of different chemicals, different antioxidants, and there's eight of them. And you've probably heard of tocopherols. So there's alpha tocopherol, beta tocopherol, gamma tocopherol, and delta tocopherol. And those are the little Greek letters before the names. But then there's tocotrienols. And again, there's alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. When we say vitamin E, we really are talking about this complex. When we look at vitamin E in terms of the supplementation that's available in health food stores or online, they're usually isolating one and maybe two of the tocopherols. So naturally, vitamin E occurs in this complex form, and it's a very potent antioxidant in the body. This is what they look like chemically. And I know for some watching this, the chemicals just like, ooh, la la, I love to see what they look like. And for some, it's like, oh, that looks scary. You don't need to know the chemical structure and know what the difference is in the molecular structure between each of those. What I'd like you to understand is the difference in function between them so that you can make clinical judgment as to which form or forms might be best suited for your client. But to the naked eye, you look at all this and you go, well, it just looks like the same chemical structure all throughout. But there's subtle differences between them. So if you look at the tocopherols versus the tocotrienols, we start with the alpha, you can see that there's some double bonds in places on the tocotrienols where there's single bonds. And the bonds are the lines between, we don't have the little chemicals there, but each of those points actually represents a chemical. So it's a hydrogen or a carbon, and there's an oxygen in there as well, and the oxygen is actually listed. So where there's just the lines, it's either understood to be carbon or hydrogen, and that's kind of a structure that we use a lot in chemistry to represent different molecules. So you can see that at between the second and the first line sticking up, the first bond sticking up on the tocotrienol, there's a double bond. You see two lines. That's a double bond, okay? So that means that there would be less molecules because there's a double bond in between them. And then same thing, you know, between each of them, the tocotrienols and the tocopherols, there's a difference is those double bonds. The difference between the alpha tocopherol and the beta tocopherol is actually a little bit more subtle than that. And to the naked eye, it's really, really hard to see. And the difference is if you look in the alpha, there's a bond sticking out up at the top. You see the OH off the top, that's oxygen and hydrogen. Then you see the line coming down at the bottom where you don't have that in the beta. Okay. And then in the gamma, I'm looking to see what the difference is there, and I'm struggling to see it. It has to do with, well, the difference between the gamma and the delta is the same, where you have that double bond that's missing. And then with the alpha, the gamma and the delta, you don't have the bond coming off the top, right? You see that at the very top of the peak at the 12 o'clock mark on the alpha and the beta, there's a bond up there. Whereas on the gamma and the alpha, in the gamma, there's a bond down at the, like, say, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock point. And in the delta, it's on the 6 o'clock. Now, do you need to memorize that? No. I mean, like I'm saying, I'm looking at it and we're going, woo, it's all, you get a little confused. But it's just knowing that there's a lot of difference in function with very little difference in structure. And the reason I like to point this out all the time is that a lot of times when somebody's on, say, a synthetic versus the actual natural form of whether it's antioxidants, vitamins, hormones in particular, there'll be just a slight molecular change. And some of that molecular change is so that a drug company can patent something, because you can't patent a natural substance, right? So let's just say the difference between progesterone and the synthetic progesterone, there's actually quite a number of little differences. And they want you to think it's acting the same. The difference between estrogen and testosterone is very, very, very slight, even less than the difference between progesterone and synthetic progesterone. So we're looking at, well, wait a minute, it's a slight little difference in the molecule, yet there's a massive difference in the function, right, between estrogen and testosterone. So I keep that thing in mind whenever somebody says, well, they're close, like they're really similar. They may be similar in structure, but they're not necessarily similar in function. So one does not necessarily substitute for the other. So let's take a look at alpha tocopherol. That's the one that's most commonly in the supplements that you're going to see on the market, alpha tocopherol. It mainly functions as an antioxidant. And what an antioxidant does is it intercepts the free radicals as they're scavenging their way through the body, trying to stabilize themselves and grabbing electrons wherever they can. When they grab electrons from lipids, from fats, it causes them to be destroyed, to be oxidized. So the tocopherol, alpha tocopherol, can get in and prevent that free radical damage to the fats. And that's a good thing, because peroxidized lipids, also known as rancid lipids, are very damaging to the body. They've been implicated in heart disease, in cancer, in all sorts of inflammatory conditions. So alpha tocopherol, antioxidants, intercepts free radicals. Yes, indeed. Thank you very much. I'll take three. Maintains integrity of cell membranes throughout the body. And we know that the cell membranes are partially lipid. And we know that the fats you eat are the fats you wear. And that's something that you can tell your clients, because they get that, right? Oh, so I'm eating a rancid fat. That rancid fat gets incorporated into my cell membrane. Well, alpha tocopherol helps to prevent those cell membranes from breaking down and deteriorating, helps hold them together. It also protects the fats in the low-density lipoproteins, LDL, from oxidation. LDL is one of the forms of cholesterol. Remember, we have the good cholesterol, the bad cholesterol. That's a layperson's terms. We have HDLs and LDLs, high density and low density. And we talk a lot about that in our fat module, about the differences between them. Well, alpha tocopherol prevents the low density lipoproteins from becoming oxidized and then thus more damaging to the body and more irritating to the cardiovascular lining, the endothelial lining of the blood vessels. It also inhibits the activity of protein kinase C, which is a cell signaling molecule. And this is a cell signaling molecule that's sending generally destructive signals from one place to the next. It inhibits platelet aggregation, which is the clumping of platelets, and enhances vasodilation. So vasodilation, meaning the expansion of blood vessels, compression or contraction would be the shortening and shrinking down. If you have platelets aggregating, platelets coming together, they can form a clot, and that can hurt vasodilation. So alpha tocopherol will inhibit the platelet aggregation, and it enhances vasodilation. Now we're going to talk about different types of vitamin E, and I want you to get this clear from the beginning. There's a form called RRR, the form that is considered natural vitamin E. It's also known as D-alpha-tocopherol, D-alpha-tocopherol. So that's the form that it occurs in food. That's the natural form. And if you look at the link below, you'll see what that actually looks like. Synthetic alpha-tocopherol is labeled ALRAC or DL-alpha-tocopherol. And get this, it only has half the biological activity of the D-alpha-tocopherol or RRR. Mostly you're going to see it listed as D-alpha-tocopherol, especially on supplement bottles. But in scientific literature, if you're reading studies, you may see this RRR or the ALRAC for the synthetic. So I just wanted you to be aware of the terminology. Oftentimes, the vitamin E fortified foods contain synthetic alpha-tocopherol, and the amounts are given as a percentage of the daily value of 30 IUs. So for example, you'll see a package, you pick it up and it says, oh wow, this has vitamin E added to it, how cool. And it says it has 10%. What it means is it has approximately 3 IUs because it's based on 10% of the daily value of 30 IUs. But it doesn't usually say the form. If it doesn't say that, it's generally going to be the synthetic, which remember is about half the biological activity of the natural. So let's look at gamma-tocopherol. Gamma-tocopherol is the most common form of vitamin E in the American diet. But the blood levels are 10 times lower than for alpha-tocopherol. So that's what the gamma-tocopherol looks like. So the body preferentially retains the alpha-tocopherol, and that's by the action of a particular transfer protein in the liver called alpha-TTP. And that incorporates the alpha-tocopherol into the membranes, into the lipoproteins, into the circulating blood, and it delivers it to certain tissues. So the body prefers the alpha, but the most common form in the food is the gamma. The gamma tocopherol, let's look at it compared to the alpha. So forms of vitamin E other than alpha tocopherol are actively metabolized, means they're going to be used more. They're going to be utilized more in the body as antioxidants, as protective pieces, as opposed to incorporated into the cell membranes and incorporated into the lipoproteins of the body. Because gamma tocopherol is initially absorbed the same way as alpha, small amounts of gamma are going to be detectable in the blood and tissue. But usually they're coming in and it's actively utilized right away. When you take an antioxidant and you actively use it, it's going to break down. It becomes reduced. So it's no longer able to be it becomes oxidized itself. So it's no longer in a reduced state where it can be the oxidation. And oxidation and reduction are actually just transfer of electrons. So breakdown products of tocopherols are the metabolites. They can be detected in the urine. So there's one called the gamma tocopherol metabolites. More of the gamma tocopherol are secreted in the urine than the alpha. Remember we said because we utilize the alpha as part of the structure. So because we see more of the gamma in the urine being excreted, we believe that the gamma is less needed for use by the body. It's used as an antioxidant and some of it is excreted intact. This might be why some of the supplement companies have decided not to do mixed tocopherols, but to go with just the alpha. So let's look at gamma tocopherol and the metabolites. There's some research, although it's limited, in animals, that's indicating that the gamma tocopherol and some of its metabolites may play a role in protecting from free radical damage. We already talked about that, right? They go around and help you protect you against these free radical molecules running around trying to scavenge all your electrons. There was a study that looked at the gamma tocopherol, and they found that increased levels of the gamma tocopherol in the plasma were associated with a significantly reduced risk of prostate cancer. So that's good news for men and for your male patients that they need to have this gamma tocopherol as a protective mechanism. They also looked at alpha tocopherol and toenail selenium as being protective against prostate. Now, whoever thought of looking at how much selenium is in the toenails, not sure what the theory was behind that, But they did find that in protecting men from prostate cancer, the plasma levels of alpha tocopherol and the amount of selenium in their toenails were protective against prostate cancer. Now, I don't know very many people who have gone to the lab and had their toenails analyzed for anything. So some of the weird research that we see. Let's look at what happens if the person has a deficiency of vitamin E. Well, you're going to see some neurological symptoms, especially impaired balance and coordination. There's a term called ataxia. It's basically like, you know, the drunken sailor's gait, right? Not able to be balanced and, you know, try to stand on one leg and you topple over, try to be coordinated and touch your, you know, finger to your nose. You can't do that. Ataxia. You're also going to see injury to the sensory nerves, which can lead to something called peripheral neuropathy. We see a lot of peripheral neuropathy in diabetics because the peripheral nerves have been damaged. In the case of diabetes, they've been damaged as a result of the sugar, the excess sugar causing damage to those cells. And we talked about in our blood sugar module how the levels of sugar above 120, anytime the sugar goes above 120, you start to get some peripheral nerve damage, sensory nerves. So deficiency of vitamin E can also contribute. So you can't always tell if you have somebody who has sensory, you know, peripheral neuropathies, is it diabetic? Is it a deficiency of vitamin E? So if you're working on somebody and getting their blood sugars managed and their peripheral neuropathy doesn't go away, you work on getting their vitamin E levels up, you may see some improvement. You also can see muscle weakness. We call that myopathy. And so we see that in things like muscular dystrophy. We see that in things like multiple sclerosis. And a lot of those things can't be helped symptomatically, at least, with vitamin E. There's also damage to the eye. So we're seeing some resemblance here to diabetes, right? Retinopathy. And they call it pigmented retinopathy. So the retinas of the eyes build up some pigment, become damaged, and we start to get some blindness. So deficiency of vitamin E, the overt deficiency signs of vitamin E is not that common, but subtle signs are. So certainly if somebody has severe malnutrition, and certainly if they have a genetic defect affecting the transfer protein for the alpha tocopherol, they're going to have deficiency signs. But people who have fat malabsorption syndromes are at risk for deficiency of vitamin E as well, because it's a fat-soluble vitamin. And if somebody's missing their gallbladder, they're going to be low in their fat-soluble vitamins. So it's really helpful that you supplement people like that, because they're not necessarily going to extract them efficiently from food. And it's also important that, especially for those folks who have, like, say, fat malabsorption because of lack of gallbladder or low gallbladder function, that you do things like micellized versions or emulsified versions, which breaks it down, the fats, into teeny tiny particles that can pass through intact through the wall of the intestine without needing a lot of bile or lipase. So let's look at the nervous system and vitamin E deficiency. Well, the people most at risk for developing nervous system dysfunction as a result of vitamin E deficiency are babies. So children that have severe vitamin E deficiencies at birth can develop neurologic symptoms if they're not treated with vitamin E. So how would kids be born with a severe vitamin E deficiency? Well, guess what? Mom probably has a vitamin E deficiency too, or is eating a vitamin E deficient diet, or is eating a very high oxidant diet, and the antioxidants have been used up in the oxidation, the fatty acid oxidation. People who develop malabsorption of vitamin E in adulthood may not even develop the neurologic symptoms for 10 to 20 years because the system is already developed, but it's particularly vulnerable in a developing nervous system. So you got to be really careful about that. And so if you're working with pregnant patients, and you need to make sure that they are getting the full spectrum of their nutrition because their babies can suffer. When we look at healthy individuals who consume diets low in vitamin E, you know, not overt, like deplete this person in vitamin E, there's not a whole lot of reports on symptomatic vitamin E deficiency, like it's showing up. A lot of times these things can be subtle, similar to the diabetic retinopathies and neuropathies, they're happening for decades before they actually come through as symptoms. And that's borne out by what we're saying here, is that a lot of times you can have a vitamin E deficiency for 10 to 20 years before that person's going to start to see symptoms. So it's important not just to look for nutrients in terms of symptoms of the nutrient deficiency, but to also look at their diet for dietary adequacy. So what is the recommended daily allowance? We're going to look at a chart in a moment, but it used to be 8 milligrams for women and 10 milligrams for men. You're going to see it listed as milligrams or IUs, and there's a ratio between that, and you can do an easy conversion, and we'll show you that on the chart. The RDA revised this in the year 2000, and it went up considerably. So now it's, and it was because of a lot of studies that they did when they deliberately gave deficient diets to men. They deliberately did that. And they said, who? And it was probably a result of prostate. So let's look at the recommended daily allowance. The link is at the bottom of your slide, and that shows you what where that came from if you want to look it up. But I mean, it's really easy to find recommended daily allowance charts. Usually they're put together by the government, and this one's from the NIH.gov site. So for infants, little tiny babies, they don't need very much. 0 to 6 months, they only need 4 milligrams, which relates to 6 IUs. So some of the supplements you see are going to say IUs, and some of the supplements you're going to see are going to say milligrams. Well, it appears that to convert from milligrams to IUs, you multiply by 1.5. So if your bottle says 200 milligrams, and you're wondering how many IUs that would be, you would multiply by 1.5 and you'd get 300, okay? If you have the number in IUs, but you're looking for whatever reason for wanting to know what the milligrams are, then you would just divide by the 1.5, okay? So you see like 6 to 9, 4 to 6, 5 to 7.5. Sounds like one of those SAT classes. This is the number. If I have a 4, I'm going to convert it to a 6. If I have a 5, I'm going to convert it to a 7.5. What's the next set of numbers in this sequence? So we basically multiply it by 1.5. So breastfeeding and pregnancy, you obviously need a little bit more. Pregnancy, not much. It's actually the same. But while breastfeeding, to make sure baby doesn't get deficient, the RDA goes up. Here's a chart. You can just go to whfoods.com. I love that site. They have some great charts. If you're ever looking for what are the best sources of particular foods or of particular nutrients, you can look that up. And what shows up here is sunflower seeds tend to be the highest. And, you know, people don't necessarily eat a lot of sunflower seeds, except if they're teenage boys at ball games, and then they eat these sunflowers. That's the biggest thing they do at ball games, is they eat their sunflower seeds and spit out the seeds. And it's kind of like they're being like tough guys, like the athletes are, you know, spitting out their chewing tobacco or whatever. They spit out their sunflower seed things. And I kid you not, I've been dealing with this for a few years with a teenage son. But they're good sources of vitamin E. So if you think about the RDA being 15, right? A quarter cup of sunflower seeds has 12.31. Now our bars, my nutrition bars that I put together, have sunflower seed butter in them. So they're a good source of vitamin E. But all your green leafy vegetables are good sources. It appears that there's low amounts, but I mean, seriously, I don't eat a cup of broccoli, and I don't recommend people eat a cup of broccoli at a time. When you make some of the recipes that I provide, we're looking at several cups of these things put together in either a big salad or a big blended soup or a smoothie. So it's pretty darn easy to get the RDA. However, a lot of the studies are showing much higher levels needed for more in-depth protection. Whenever they do a study to see what's the recommended allowance, they don't look at all the possible things that can interfere. So let's look at how they actually, what they do to determine the RDA. So take a test tube, put hydrogen peroxide, add it to blood samples, and look for at what level hemolysis happens. And hemolysis is breakdown of the red blood cells, the bursting of the red blood cells. So if they have hemolysis with the hydrogen peroxide and they do certain measures, that would say vitamin E deficiency. So they keep adding the vitamin E until they get to the point where they don't get that hemolysis. And that's how they came up with the 15. That does not mean that that's the ideal number for everybody. And we know that, right? We don't look at the lab ranges as normal lab ranges. We look for the ideal lab ranges. We don't look at RDAs. We look at what's needed for optimal function. This was considered a statistically clinically relevant measure or test of vitamin E status. However, the latest RDA is based on the prevention of deficiency symptoms rather than on health promotion and prevention of chronic disease. And I think that's where the system of the RDAs falls short. Yeah, you want to make sure people are getting at least the RDAs for certain nutrients, but what is it? Where's that buffer? Where's that safety zone? So let's look at some of the conditions under which the vitamin E is necessary and used. So cardiovascular disease, you've probably seen studies on this. It's very commonly found that people who've had a heart attack or have risk of heart attack or have angina are recommended to take somewhere between 400 and 800 IUs of vitamin E. Now that's substantially more than the RDA. If you think about the RDA being 22.5 IUs, compared to 400 to 800, we're looking at 20 to 35 times the amount. So why, where'd these numbers come from? Well, there's been a lot of studies, at least 5 observational studies. Observational meaning they just watched people. They didn't do interventions, they did observation. They just watched what happened. And they suggested that as the vitamin E increased, the incidence of death from heart disease, from myocardial infarction, heart disease, was less in both men and women. So that's a correlation. That's something we all want. Every study that was done was a prospective study. So it measured their vitamin E consumption in people that were supposed to be healthy, followed them for a number of years to determine how many were diagnosed or died as a result of heart disease. So that's not like a clinical, a controlled trial where there's an intervention given, a placebo given, and then the results followed. There are some studies like that. So there was a study done on bypass and vitamin E. It was a small study, but you can't always throw out a study just because it's small. It does give more credence to a study when there's a large group studied. These people had a history of coronary artery bypass surgery, and those that took at least 100 IUs of supplemental alpha tocopherol, or equivalent to 60 or 67 milligrams of the RR alpha tocopherol. Remember, the RRR is the natural form. They had a reduction in the progression of coronary artery atherosclerosis measured by angiography. And angiography is a contrast where they look and they put some contrast dye into an artery and look to see the blockages. So the people who took more than 100 IUs or equivalent of 67 milligrams, they were a lot less likely to develop cardiovascular disease in the progression. So they looked and said, oh, their artery disease isn't progressing. They'd had a bypass, and now let's see if their arteries are getting clogged up again. So this seems like 100 IUs was protective. Here's another cardiovascular disease study. In 2 of the studies, individuals who consumed more than 7 milligrams a day of tocopherol from food were only approximately 35% as likely to die from heart disease as those who consumed less than 3 to 5 milligrams. So the more it got, and this we're still less than the RDA. So they were still less likely. So the lower you get, the more deficient you get, the more at risk for heart disease you are. So there were 2 big studies that observed a clinically significant reduced risk of heart disease, but only in women who consumed at least 100 IUs of supplemental RR alpha tocopherol, which is the equivalent of 67 milligrams. So it pays to make sure that your clients have good levels of vitamin E, especially if they have a history of atherosclerosis or a family history of heart disease. Here's another study, or several. that observed that the plasma or red blood cell levels of alpha tocopherol, remember, we're not just looking in the plasma all the time, we can actually look at the cells. And for certain nutrients, that the place to measure it is not necessarily the plasma, the serum, the blood. It's actually in the cells, in the red blood cells or the white blood cells. You get a more accurate idea. So for this study, it was a little bit different. They had a large trial. It was 39,876 women in the Women's Health Study, a huge, long, multi-year study, lots and lots of women. And they gave them 600 IUs, the equivalent of 400 milligrams, of RRR alpha tocopherol every other day for 10 years. And what they found is it didn't have a difference in the incidence of myocardial infarction, heart attack, or stroke, but it decreased the number of cardiovascular-related deaths by 24%, which only goes to show that you can still have certain symptomatology, in this case pretty severe symptomatology of having a heart attack or stroke, but still be at lower risk as a result of an intervention. So that was an interesting study, I thought. So there's more studies in various other kinds of cardiovascular disease, thromboembolism, which is a blood clot basically in the leg. So this was in the same study, the Women's Health Study, showed that vitamin E intervention caused a 21% reduction in the risk of venous thromboembolism, which is good because when you have clots, when you have them in your legs, those embolisms can be thrown off, get into the bloodstream, and then get stuck in the lungs and cause a serious complications. There was another large randomized control study of middle-aged men, and they observed that supplementing with 400 IUs of synthetic alpha tocopherol every other day for 8 years had no significant effect on the risk of major cardiovascular effects. So the first study used 600 IUs or milligrams. Let's see, 600 IUs. This study used 400. It was men versus women. So there didn't seem to be much of a change, and they were all, okay, and the difference also is natural versus synthetic. The first study that found a 24% decrease in cardiovascular deaths was with natural tocopherol, the RRR form, at 600 IUs. This was the synthetic at 400 IUs. And if you remember when we started out, I said that the synthetic is about half the effectiveness of the natural. So effectively, this was 200 versus 600 IUs of the natural tocopherol. And this is for 8 years, no significant effect. So there's been lots of studies, and some of them are poo-pooing, like, oh yeah, we don't need vitamin E, and sometimes worse. But you have to look at the amounts that's given, the length of time, the gender, the situation, and whether it's a natural or synthetic version. Vitamin E can also be helpful for people with cataracts and preventing cataracts. Cataracts are these little film over the eye that a lot of people get as they age. And they're formed by this protein oxidation in the lens of the eye, and it causes this film. You can see in the picture, this very, it's like filmy, and that's what basically people see. It's like this hot, foggy haziness over their vision, okay? They were found that oxidation of that protein in the lens of the eye can be prevented by alpha tocopherol. But there were mixed studies in the report. So sometimes you make an observation or a theory about how something's going to work based on knowing the science and the biochemistry. And sometimes it plays out in clinical practice and in studies, and sometimes it doesn't. So there were some mixtures of the studies. Some said it did, some said it didn't. But my opinion when you have something like that is it's worth a try, isn't it? Right? Instead of having the person having to develop the cataract and make it get worse and worse and then have to have surgery, as soon as you have a first early sign of it, or even a risk of it, like say they had in one eye and they don't have it in the other, the chances are that the chemistry, unless it's changed significantly, is going to predispose them to have it in the other eye. So why not do an intervention to see if it works? It's not going to hurt. So let's look at the immune function in vitamin E. It is a potent antioxidant. And it appears that it enhances specific actions of the immune system, the ones that seem to disappear or decline as people age. So here's a randomized placebo-controlled trial. That's different than an observational study. Randomized placebo-controlled trial is where they have one group that gets the placebo, one group that gets the actual thing that they're studying, but nobody really knows who. It's kind of randomly done, and the doctors, nobody really knows. That's called the double blind. This was in a nursing home, and they supplemented with 200 IUs of synthetic alpha tocopherol, which would be the equivalent of 90 milligrams of RR tocopherol, so the actual, for a year. And it significantly lowered the risk of respiratory infection. So even at that lower dose, the vitamin E is very effective. So you have people who are at risk of respiratory infections. They get a lot of colds. They get a lot of flus. Then it works well. It didn't seem to have an effect on lung infections, the lower respiratory, but certainly for upper respiratory infections, in the throat, in the nose, very good response there from vitamin E. What about cancer, right? The big C. So a lot of types of cancer are thought to result from oxidative damage to the DNA caused by free radicals. And what do we say that vitamin E is good for? It's good and helps protect against free radical damage. So there have been a number of different studies that have looked at it, and some very large ones, and they studied it with lung and breast cancer, and it didn't seem to help. So that's still some of the things that researchers are pondering. And is it the structure of the study? Is it that it doesn't work? But again, it's so protective in other ways, and theoretically it should be, that it isn't necessarily bad news to insert that into a cancer patient's regime. Make sure they're eating vitamin C-rich foods, etc. They did find, however, that there was a good correlation between vitamin E and prostate cancer risk. So there was a randomized controlled trials, and the placebo-controlled reported a 34% reduction in the incidence of prostate cancer in smokers given daily supplementation of only 50 milligrams of synthetic alpha tocopherol, which is equivalent to 25 milligrams of the RRR. So very promising for the prostate. So let's talk a little bit more about using vitamin E with cancer and some of the things that have been done that have been more successful. Cancer cells grow. They grow really, really fast, and they're resistant to what's called apoptosis. And apoptosis is programmed cell death. So typically cells grow, and then pop, you think of apoptosis. I think about them exploding and going away. We want that to happen with our cancer cells. We want that to happen with cells as they get older and they get more stiff and resilient. We want them to die, and then we want new cells to replace them. There's a lot of problems that can come about through lack of apoptosis. So there have been some studies in cell cultures that indicated that a specific vitamin E ester called alpha tocopherol succinate. So notice it's not all O-L, it's Y-L, succinate. And it's an ester. It means it's been esterified, combined with another molecule, in this case, succinate. And it can inhibit the proliferation, the growth, and induce apoptosis in different kinds of cancer cells. So what happens in these cultures is that, boom, you cause the death of these cancer cells and slowing down of the growth of the remaining ones. But it's important to note that the studies have shown that it's alpha tocopherol succinate, not alpha tocopherol, in order to do this. So let's talk about diabetes. Diabetes is becoming an epidemic, and no wonder, because if we look at the diets and the lifestyle that most people are following, with lots of processed foods and a sedentary lifestyle, it's no wonder that diabetes is on the rise. So there's a biochemical marker of oxidative stress called F2-isoprostanes. And this has been found to be elevated in type 2 diabetics. So they supplemented with 600 milligrams of synthetic, equivalent to 300 milligrams of RRR, for 14 days. And that reduced levels of this biomarker. Now, how that plays out in the actual reduction of cancer, it's still in the experimental stage. This is another one of those things that on paper it looks great, and let's just see. Let's just see what happens. So the puzzle of Alzheimer's, man, this is a slow torture. If you've ever watched someone as they develop through and progress through Alzheimer's, it's really frightening and it's really scary. It's probably scarier than developing a physical ailment, you know, where you can't walk all that well, because the body's in pretty good shape, but the mind is gone. And you grasp for words, you lose them. You look at faces and you can't put names to them. And after a while, you don't even recognize faces unless it's somebody you've known for decades and decades. And after a while, like, parents don't even recognize their own kids. I watched this happen with my mother-in-law, and she went from pretty clear and lucid at 86 to, like, by 88 and then definitely at 90. Boy, she was definitely, she'd lost it. I would have a conversation with her, and she wouldn't know my name. Or she'd say, oh, it's so nice to see you. You know, where are you living now? Oh, what are your kids' names again? Oh, yeah, that's right. And then it got so bad that she'd start a sentence and couldn't finish the sentence because too much time had elapsed and she didn't remember what the sentence was that she started with. And it was extremely frustrating for her because she'd try to say something and she just, what was I saying? What? It just got worse and worse. So it's a really, it's not a good disease. And whatever we can do to help people who have relatives with Alzheimer's or who have Alzheimer's or are at high risk of Alzheimer's or just want to prevent getting Alzheimer's, because it's not pretty at all. So oxidative stress, right? Brain tissue is mostly fat. So it's really, really sensitive to oxidative stress. And studies have found that low vitamin E is a risk factor in Alzheimer's disease. Low vitamin E levels have been found in the cerebrospinal fluid of patients with Alzheimer's disease. So when they did these large intervention trials with individuals with moderate neurological impairment, found that 2,000 IUs of synthetic alpha tocopherol daily for years, equivalent of 900 milligrams a day of the natural, significantly slowed progression of Alzheimer's dementia. Now, that's a huge amount, right? That's a lot more than the amount that's typically in a daily supplement. It's a lot more than the RDA. A lot of the supplements that are intended for cardiovascular disease, reducing the risk of blood clots, are usually in the neighborhood of 800 IUs. So 2,000 is a significant amount. Now, are there downsides? Yeah, we'll look at some of the downsides, but sometimes the downsides are worth the risk compared to the downsides or the risk of having the deficiency. So let's look at the toxicity. Very few toxicity effects have been noticed in adults taking supplements of less than 2,000 milligrams of alpha tocopherol. So yeah, not a bad deal, right? So most studies of toxicity or side effects have lasted only a few weeks to a few months. So we really don't know what the long-term effects of excessive vitamin E would be. But it's possible that the only thing that they found was that it could increase the likelihood of hemorrhage. Now that could be significant because the risk of hemorrhagic stroke could be high. Now, what's hemorrhagic stroke versus a clot, you know, a blockage kind of stroke? Typical kind of stroke we think about is that we get a blood clot, it gets up into the brain, it blocks off the vessels to the major centers in the brain, the person loses function in that area. A hemorrhagic stroke is where there's too much anticoagulation going on, and vitamin E is a potent anticoagulant. And what happens is you get a bleeding. So you can have bleeding of certain parts of the brain. Maybe there's a slight bump to the head and that causes internal bleeding that nobody even knows about. You hemorrhage and that causes hematoma to form and that causes, you know, can cause death. So it's a risk of that, but the studies show that at 2,000, it has to, if you're at less than 2,000, you're not at high risk. So I think when you're supplementing, you just have to play around and make sure that you don't put people into a high risk. And of course, some of the studies, you have to look at how much did they give and how much did the person weigh. So if they used adult men as the subjects and found that if, as long as you didn't go over 2,000, you weren't at risk, well, that doesn't mean that a petite 110-pound female can tolerate 200, right? 2,000, I mean. So it's just being careful. And I generally don't put people on higher than 800 to 1,000. I use a vitamin E at a time. And I work at other things related to Alzheimer's. And we'll talk about that in other sections of the course, you know, like blood sugar balance and MCT oils and things like that, and gluten and avoidance. So I don't really mess with this too much. I think it's something that you really just have to be careful with, because you don't want to have people have a stroke and come back and blame you. So as long as you keep it under 1,000, you're definitely safe. As long as you keep it under 2,000, you know, you're clinically safe according to the studies. There are interactions between vitamin E and some drugs. So certainly if you have somebody on anticoagulant drugs and they're on vitamin E, you're going to increase their risk of bleeding, right? Because they're, both of those things are doing the same thing. So some of those are Coumadin, warfarin. There's antiplatelet drugs called like Plaxil. And then there's another one called Pursetine. So asking people what medications they're on is a critical part of your history taking. You must get those down and you must write those down. And then if you're going to be supplementing and helping them with their diet stuff, look those drugs up just to see if there's any interactions. And it's really easy to do these days with the internet. When I first started doing this, well, the internet didn't even exist, so you had to buy books. And then as we started to have access to computers, there would be programs you could buy. You know, you'd buy like for $1,000, you'd get the PDR, the physician's desk reference, online. You know what the problem was with that is it changes all the time. So every year you'd have to update it for another few $100. So it's a really expensive thing to keep track of what drugs and interactions. Now you just go to good old Google and you type the name of the drug, you type interaction, you type nutrients, and it'll give you everything you need. So it's really cool, very easy to do, and highly recommend you do that with your clients when you get them in for the first visit or second visit. People that are on blood thinners or who are vitamin K deficiency shouldn't take alpha tocopherol unless you're watching them. So you have somebody who's monitoring their blood, monitoring their prothrombin time, and monitoring to make sure that they're not going to hemorrhage. So that's the only risk really of high levels, but it's a significant one, right? So what are some of the food sources? Well, we looked at that list. You've got lots of the vegetable oils or the vegetable, you know, whole food fats, right? So olives, sunflower, safflower. I'm not a fan of sunflower and safflower oils, but eating sunflower seeds are great. I've never eaten a safflower, so I don't know what they're like. But nuts, generally speaking, have good levels of vitamin E. Whole grains, they have to be, you know, avoid taking off the germ. But when I'm not a big fan of grains in general, especially not things like gluten. So even though vitamin E is predominant, very, very high in the germ of the wheat, I'm still cautious about that because of gluten intolerance. And of course, green leafy vegetables, they have quite a bit. We saw that on our list before. We saw that spinach, I think, had like, or broccoli had something like, I don't remember what it was, like 14 or something per cup. So you, it adds up if you eat a lot of green leafy vegetables and cruciferous vegetables. So all of the forms, the alpha, the beta, the gamma, the delta, all of them are occurring naturally in foods. It just varies from food to food. So in taking supplements, when people did some studies of the diets of Americans, and that this included enriched and fortified sources, so that's not even naturally occurring. For individuals 2 years and older, was 6.9 milligrams a day. The RDA is 15. So most people are deficient in it. Why? Because they don't eat whole foods. They don't eat green leafy vegetables. They don't generally eat raw nuts and seeds. And when you roast or heat up nuts or seeds, anything with oil in it, you oxidize it, and that eats up the vitamin E. So you'll notice that a lot of oils, like flax oil, a lot of brands of flax oil, they add vitamin E to it because the oil, after it's been pressed, naturally breaks down. You can't count on the vitamin E in, say, a bottle of oil to be adding to your daily requirement, because it's not. It's just acting on the oil, and it's being used up as an antioxidant there to protect the oil. But it is a good thing to do to put some vitamin E in some of these oils. Generally speaking, vitamin E is pressed from soybean oil. but you can find it in you can find non you can find it in sunflower, because sunflower was at the top of the list. So sunflower based vitamin E can be very helpful too. A lot of people believe it's hard for an individual to consume more than the 1500 milligrams a day from food alone without going too high in fat. But seriously, if you look at the chart, which was back around, let me find the chart. If you recommend people to eat the way we've been discussing getting people to eat, there it is, right? They don't have to get a lot of fat to get their vitamin E because of the green leafy vegetables. So yeah, sunflower seeds, 200 calories, but you're already at 12.31. You're already close to the 15 right there just with the sunflower. So if you were to make like a sunflower seed pate and put in a bunch of spinach and broccoli in there, you're already up to what, 12, 15, that's 16. You're already up to 18. So if you start to do like a big soup that has, you know, steamed and blended down broccoli and other food and other cruciferous, you eat it. You eat a green smoothie with like 4 cups of green leafy vegetables. You've got something like 10 milligrams right there. And then you add some sunflower seeds to it and you're good to go. Almonds are 6. We don't generally eat a whole quarter cup at a time. It's not a bad thing. I mean, so a little bit of an almond butter sauce over the spinach. So it's not that hard to get. I don't believe it's hard to get. It's looking at the standard American diet. We think, yeah, it's really hard to get. If you get them to eat in a really whole foods, high green diet, you know, you're not going to have a problem getting them to have that. To get them into therapeutic range, of course, to get them into the several hundred milligrams for cardiovascular protection or cancer protection, obviously that's going to be challenging to do without them eating a boatload of sunflower seeds and almonds and even with the green leafy vegetables. So you really have to look at what's the propensity of your client. What's their risk factor? If they have prostate cancer, and we saw that, you know, 600 IUs were good for prostate cancer, let's give them a supplement. I love to get supplementation from the whole foods, but it's not always possible in a case of disease. There are the specific supplements, we looked at this with cancer research earlier, that are available in the ester form. So we looked at tocopherol succinate, there's also acetate as well. They're more resistant to the oxidation, so they don't break down as much. And so for storage purposes, they can last. When they're taken orally, they get converted in the intestine into the alpha tocopherol, so that the esterification process protects them before they get into the body. Once they're in the body, it gets broken down and it's used as the main thing. When you look at supplements, you're going to see a lot of them that are just alpha tocopherol. Some of them are going to say mixed tocopherols. It's usually best to go with a natural form vitamin E. Remember the RRR form. And mixed, so that way you mimic nature. A lot of times you don't find that, so you may be able to find a low dose mixed and then add on the extra alpha. And regardless of what you're doing, just make sure that you're looking for the highest quality you can. Some of these on this picture are not exactly the best. You know, CVS is not exactly high quality name, so I would really watch what are their processes for extracting the vitamin E. It could be completely oxidized by the time you get it. So you really do need to have something that's very, very carefully chosen. So that's it for our vitamin E presentation. I hope you learned a lot from this and just really, you know, take heed with what vitamin E does, how it works in the body, what the levels of supplementation are, and how you can look at your client to see if they're at risk or need extra vitamin E.